cat stopped in the middle of the path and then it stared straight at me. I was terrified. It'll bring a tear to my eye thinking about it, just my emotion that I felt that day.
I just froze. Didn't want to move because I didn't want it coming towards me or anything, something like that. You think, where the hell has that come from?
Welcome to Big Cat Conversations. We speak directly to people who've encountered one of Britain's big cats. We also discuss the bigger picture. I'm Rick Minter, and thanks for joining me. Hi everyone, welcome to Big Cat Conversations, and here we are with episode 100. And as you can hear, I'm not alone. We're in a pub in deepest Herefordshire amongst the cider orchards, and there are 25 people gathered around, friends and allies and big cat witnesses, people who are boots on the ground, investigators, and people who are interested in trail cameras and thermal cameras and recording cats if they can, speaking to landowners, and in the cultural aspects of big cats. So a real mixed gathering of people. Amongst the list here, I reckon 11 people in the room are witnesses, some people have had several sightings, and we've got three up front for interviews coming up in a moment. But the different aspect about this event is that because we're in a pub, everybody's going to help me ask the questions. Later on, we've got more discussion points about tracking big cats and the cultural aspects of big cats and what we make of the whole mystery and where we go in the future. So a lot of ground to cover. Thanks to everybody listening back home across the world to this podcast, and thanks to everybody in the room, because we're a big community on this, and it's so nice with episode 100 just to have a chat in the pub. There were different options for what we could do with episode 100, but we thought, actually, it's the people's podcast. Let's just go to a pub and have a friendly conversation and listen to more witnesses. So first up is actually a very important guy, because he was the person who suggested more than anybody that I ought to damn well do a podcast and listen to the witnesses. And I actually, 6 months after he made the recommendation, thought, yeah. And I've got a son who does audio. It's all lining up, actually. So, David Smith, thank you very much. We then got Fleur on the cultural aspects of big cats, and she's seen a couple in different parts of the country. And then Nick, very interesting that Nick just came along to the pub tonight. Because he'd seen one relatively recently, so he's a sort of spontaneous extra guest up front with us. So thanks, Nick, for joining us. So, David, can we have your 5 minutes on the key aspects of your sighting and encounters, please?
Certainly. Set the scene. The first sighting, I'd been out shooting. I was on my way back up to the car in a bit of a valley. There was woods both sides of me, left and right, about 100 yards apart, either side of me, and all the sheep from the right started to run across in front of me, right in front of me. They weren't bunching up, they were scattered, all running for their lives. So what are they running from? So I looked across, and there was one sheep by itself over by the fence, pig netting fence, two strands of barbed wire on the top. And I looked across, and there was a sheep, so I brought the scope up. Why isn't it running? It was a puma. Plain, outright puma. I could see it as plain as a pikestaff through the scope. There was no doubt. I didn't shoot because I'd only got a 2.2 rim fire, so it wouldn't have even injured it properly. So that was a big eye-opener. I didn't really believe in big cats until then. About 5-6 years later, I saw another cat. I was out walking the dogs. We were walking through a blackcurrant patch. I was on the headland. The dogs were both rabbiting off in the bushes. And this was probably August, September time. So fruit was on, heavy leaf, couldn't see anything. But I heard one of the dogs coming back, and it ran straight out of the row in front of me. This is about 11 o'clock at night. Ran out about 6 feet in front and took off up the headland. And I thought, she's obviously after a rabbit. A few seconds later, she ran out again, and I'm thinking, hang on, that's slightly smaller, what's that? That was the actual dog. I switched the torch on. That was my actual dog, one of them. German Shepherd, and she was smaller than what she was chasing. I followed up quickly. My lurcher came out as well, and she was off in hot pursuit of both of them. and they started barking at the bottom of an apple tree in the hedge, and I put the light on and a big torch, and I put it on the cat, and as I got nearer and nearer, it was looking down at the dogs and then up at me, back to the dogs and up, and it did this all the way. I was walking to it for about 70 yards. I got within 15 yards and it took one final look at me, and it turned and just jumped out of the tree over the other side of the hedge and fence and off down an orchard. There was no two ways about it. It was a big black leopard. They're there. I know lots of people that have seen them. I've met a gamekeeper. He showed me these pictures in the shop the one day after a lot of badgering from a friend, a mutual friend. And he showed me some photos, and they were absolutely spot on. They were shot on a trail camera, series of threes, and the one, it was only taken about 20 feet, and you saw the cat walking. Then that was the first picture. Second picture, it started to turn its head. Third picture, it was staring straight at the camera. It was right by a five-barred gate. And this cat was a good 2'4" tall. And again, you couldn't argue that it was anything else but a big cat. It was really good quality picture. He will not release it. He won't even send it to Rick. He does not want anyone going on his land. If it ever got out, he's had friends where information's got out, and they have people going around with guns, bows, all sorts, trying to catch these cats. And it just causes mayhem. So he will not, under any circumstances, release those pictures. Those pictures will go to the grave with him. I've also seen good video of a she-cat with at least two cubs. And again, you can't argue with that. But that won't be released. I've had other experiences. I've heard a leopard, I'm pretty sure it was a leopard, take a muntjac. That was a blood-curdling noise right down the woods. A friend of mine heard that with me. I've been followed by something in the wood. That was a bit hairy, to say the least. It was pacing me. I was just on the edge of the wood walking down the drive, and it paced me. Every time I stopped, it stopped. And I had a rifle with me, and I walked 40 feet away from the wood. I felt really being hunted, being paced. And a fortnight later, a neighbour had exactly the same experience in the same place. And he very coyly came forward with that info. Various cats have been shot, and caught.
Thank you for that. Lots of thought-provoking points there, which we'll pick up in a minute with the audience. Can I just clarify, this is all in, I know we keep locations vague, this is mid and west Herefordshire generally, is it, these incidents?
My two sightings were just over in Worcestershire. I won't say any more because I don't want to cause trouble there.
Okay, but your grapevine, where you hear about other things going on, is largely Herefordshire, is that right?
Largely Herefordshire, Worcestershire, Gloucestershire.
Okay, yeah. Brilliant. Thanks ever so much, David. Sit there and we'll have you cross-examined in a minute. And next person is Fleur. Fleur was based at British Museum, where she saw many symbols and signs of big cats in culture and folklore there. And she'll tell us a bit about that later on. So she had that sort of interest from a career perspective, but also based near Malvern, not far away. But you're going to talk us through your main sightings in Dorset and in Oxfordshire. So thank you, Fleur, for coming along.
Thank you. And I also, if I may, mention a very similar incident to what has already been described, which happened to my nephew in Oxfordshire, where he was tracked by a black panther in the Witchwood Forest. And this was round about the same time as I had the Oxfordshire sighting. Anyway, the Dorset sighting, I went on numerous occasions to Arne on the Isle of Purbeck to do bird watching and look at the wildlife and so forth. And this was a sighting near Corfe Castle. It was one of the classic big cat crossing the road at dusk scenarios that we've heard lots of instances of in the podcasts. So it's unfortunate that the detail isn't crystal clear because we were in a moving car, but both myself in the passenger seat and my friend who was holidaying with in the driving seat both saw it. She first said, "There's a cat," and I looked up. She'd watched it come out of the hedge on the left-hand side, traverse the road, not too fast and reasonably far away. I immediately looked up and we both watched it cross the rest of the road to the right, go up through the vegetation and disappear. And it was dusk, so it was fairly dark. I asked my friend afterwards. We found a parking place and we parked up and discussed the sighting. We were both quite shaken. I said, "What do you think that was?" And she said, "Black panther." It looked like a black panther. She said about the size of a spaniel. And I was thinking a little bit taller than that. I thought more like a medium-sized deer. What I was aware of very much was a thick back legs and a sort of raised bit at the back and a sort of mobility to it as it slunk through the vegetation. So this is something that really preyed on our minds. We went back the next day in daylight. We also went out onto the heathland, which is much more open, and had a hunt about there. I did see something. Well, there was no livestock on the heath. There was a black animal, a largish black animal, about 4 foot long, lying down. So we stopped the car, we went back, and there was nothing. So those are my Dorset sightings. Every time I go back, we're looking like we can at any possibility of seeing the cat. We know that Jonathan McGowan, who's a naturalist expert, as we know in that area, he said because of the deer population and the locality and the fact it's a nature reserve, you may have lynx, you may have a black panther, leopard, you may even have a mountain lion, cougar type big cat. So that's really quite exciting. With regard to Oxfordshire, I do want to share just a couple of things. I went on a weekly basis to an area, just a private house, just abutting onto the Whiteham Woods. The Whiteham Woods goes across Oxfordshire. It's hundreds and hundreds of acres under study by Oxford University. So that's Whiteham Woods. And it sort of bleeds on to the Wychwood Forest. Wychwood Forest was where there's been a lot of sightings of what became known as the Charlbury Panther, later celebrated in a black sculpture that you can see from the train that gives everybody a very exciting moment till they realise that it's not moving at all. Anyway, my nephew was the first, as a youngish man, walking in the Wychwood Forest. He was again tracked. Every time he stopped, hearing branches crack and so forth, it would stop. He would walk on, it would stop again. And he saw it, and I asked, "What sort of cat was this?" And he immediately said it was a black cat panther. It was jet black. And in the end, he said, "I was so spooked and so frightened." He was a youngish man. He said, "I ran. I just ran, and I do regret running. I mean, for whatever reason." Anyway, he managed to leave the cat behind. So that was maybe the Charlbury panther of the Wychwood. My sighting was of a smaller cat, but why I find it very memorable was that it was sitting up on the area just at the edge of the woodland in pasture, farmland, and it was sitting like a sphinx. It had its front legs and paws out like this. As I walked up the side of the road, level with it, and this is about 100 yards away on my left, and it's sitting, sunning itself, I think, in the open pasture before the wood encroaches, it appeared to see me, and it was quite extraordinary. It was like it was stung by a bee, and it just jumped in the air, and the tail flew out. And at that point, I realised that the tail was much longer than a normal domestic or even a feral farm cat would be. And I just watched it. And as I watched it, it just shot up through the pasture and into the woods. And that was the last I ever saw of that cat. As I have discussed with Rick, I wonder whether it was a large feral from the farm. But whatever it was, the length of the tail was exceptional. And it was black. But I was too far away and it moved too fast to be able to clarify any detail. So I've got other sightings that it would be quite interesting just to mention in passing, one off the Isle of Skye, where I saw a wildcat eating roadkill off the side of the road, just off the Isle of Skye on the top of a mountain, and we were again driving, but I got a good look at it.
Fleur, that was a Scottish wildcat, European
wildcat. That
was a
Scottish wildcat, but as we know, they are functionally extinct, which is extraordinarily sad. I mean, this month, 22 wildcat kittens have been released with collars in the Cairngorms, and we hope this will reseed the wildcat population up there, because so many of them are hybridized with domestics, it's become corrupt and the DNA is corrupt. So a lot of them that have been released now have actually been of captive populations in collections where their DNA is better preserved. So let's pray for the future of that endeavor. Anyway, towards that, I'm trying to raise some money by doing tours of the British Museum on the subject of divine cat. And I'm doing two in August. And these are to try and introduce people to the fact that cats have always been revered in societies. And whether these are small cats, like the goddess Bast in ancient Egypt, or the lioness goddess Sekhmet, the panther of Dionysus, the ocelot, the jaguar of Mexico, the leopard of Africa, the Near Eastern lions. We have an absolute abundance of cultures which have revered the feline in many forms and have given it respect and have mythologized it, if you like. So, and one thing I just wanted to briefly mention is the Spoonley Wood panther, because the Roman villa at Spoonley Wood in Gloucestershire, excavated there in the early part of the 20th century, dug up a large statue of the god of wine and ecstasy and dance, Dionysus, known by the Romans as Bacchus, with his panther. That is from Gloucestershire. Everybody who wants to come to the British Museum to see that, that's in the Romano-British Upper Galleries, and you can meet the panther accompaniment there. And we also have a wonderful treasure, the Mildenhall treasure, which was found in Suffolk, and this has a great silver dish called the Neptune dish. All the way around are Dionysus and people playing pan pipes and people dancing and fauns and satyrs and maenads and so forth, and there is the panther again, beautiful silver panther made out of Rapuse silver on the bell. So do come and have a look at those. Anybody wants to, interested in that, coming up in London, I'm happy to show people.
Splendid. Really good to know about that. And we'll catch up with cultural aspects of big cats right at the end in the final sort of 10 minutes of the show. So we now have a gatecrasher, and we're delighted to have a gatecrasher, because as we were setting up, Nick, who's just joined us now, came to us and said, what's going on here? Can I join in? And we said, well, it depends. And he's a local witness and a recent witness, so he definitely can join in. So, Nick, thanks ever so much for coming in at the last second. And sock it to us. What have you got to tell us?
Right. I'm a very keen country walker. I live on the edge of the Forest of Dean, but do most of my walking in Herefordshire or Wales. Like lots of people who are interested in these things, I've spotted, I think, two or three panthers over the years, but so far away, I couldn't be absolutely sure. On the 19th of May, I was walking from Hay-on-Wye. Not far from the centre of the town, there was a fence to my left-hand side. I was walking a short distance from the fence, walked to the corner of the field where there was a field gate, and I saw something move. I couldn't tell what it was. I didn't dream it was anything special, but I went through the field gate, closed it behind me, and turned to my left. 2 metres in front of me was the field fence, and I had a clear view of no obstructions at all. This beast leapt from my right-hand side from foliage across a clear view in front of me and disappeared to my left. It was astonishing. It was 2 metres away from me. It was reddish brown. It was the size of a large Labrador. It was sleek. It had incredible markings on it that were either dark brown or black and were regular, more square, peculiarly, than round. I hadn't got my camera. I didn't have time to get that. I didn't see its head. I only saw its body, which mesmerized me. It just shot across in front of me. I was in awe of what I saw. It was just incredible. It was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And I now know without any shadow of a doubt that there are big cats here. It was absolutely mind-blowing. It just disappeared to the side and to the left of me. Absolutely wonderful. I carried on walking, looking around, hoping I might see something else. And I happened to bump into a group of walkers. I told them what I'd just seen. And the lead walker there said that the previous year she had seen what she was sure was a big cat at night time on the road in the Hay and Wye area. When I'd finished my walk, I went back to the Tourist Information Bureau in Hay on Wye to report this. I thought they'd be interested, but they weren't. I was very disappointed with that. Absolutely wonderful. Goose pimples up and down my back. It was just a fabulous thing to see.
Right. I'm going to trespass on the audience's chance to ask questions, because just a point of clarification. Can you tell us what you think the scale was, say, compared to a Labrador? Did you see a tail, and did it notice you, and what kind of vibes did you get from it in relation to its association with you? Was it just getting out of the way, or did it not even notice you?
The vibe I had was that it felt that it was cornered, because it was in long grass off to the side by the fence. The only way it could go was either bounding to its left across open land or carrying on in the direction it was moving into further undergrowth. I think it was just getting away from me. I must have seen its tail. I didn't see its head because it was just so quick. I must have seen its tail, but that had no impression on me. The impression it gave me was that its body was so sleek and reddish brown and covered in these incredibly almost regular markings. I can't describe it in any other way. It was just awe-inspiring. I've heard people describe sightings of the cats being as big as a Labrador, and I think that's accurate. It was an animal that had no spare flesh. It was just sleek and tight, and it was just wonderful.
Splendid. That will do. I think that's wonderful. Thank you for being a late entry into our agenda. And we've now got discussion and questions from amongst our audience here. And final section of the questions and comments, I want to also to be about, what do all these sightings across all these podcast episodes add up to? You know, what's the collective view? You know, what are we learning from all these sightings reports? We've had, you know, three or four tonight. But let's start with points to these guys who are up front. I think Craig has raised his hand first. So, Craig, welcome. Craig is local in Herefordshire. Craig was with us for episode 72, started with sightings on Exmoor when he was a lad learning his farming trade, and hopes to retire there, I think, one day. But, Craig, welcome back. Good to see you. And what's your point?
Question for all of the witnesses, really. Sighting these magnificent animals, and I've seen a few of them, has it affected how you enjoy the countryside? And do you now turn into looking for spore and signs everywhere you go, or can you just enjoy a walk? Or are you genuinely concerned that you might bump into one of these cats? Or are you more careful about how you keep your pets? Or are they on a lead? Do you keep a closer eye on them? Would you have any concerns about walking in areas that are hot spots for these animals, or not at all?
Thank you, Craig. Let's quickly go in order. David first, then Craig, then Fleur.
Personally, it does make you a lot more aware of your surroundings. I was very wary for the first couple of 3 weeks after my first sighting. The second one, it was plain that cat just wanted to get away from me, which I actually found quite reassuring. If it had stood its ground, I'd have been very concerned, but no, it just wanted to get out of there. The only time I've ever felt really threatened was when that thing was following me through the wood. That was very unnerving, and it put me off going outside for a few days.
So, David, just a slight part two to the question for you then. So I do a lot of shooting. Would you, if you're in that position again, you felt you're endangered and you're armed, would you shoot the cat?
If it was coming for me, no question.
Okay.
I'd bury it as quick as I could. I was carrying the rifle in the shoulder, pointing at the woods, ready, because they are so quick. I wouldn't have got a second shot off.
But David, just to clarify that, emotionally, you're not somebody who wants to shoot a cat. Though,
no.
I've spoken to you in the pub and whatever. You're pretty protective of them, and you know lots of people like that from the shooting.
I know a lot of people who shoot, and if it was causing damage, quite a few of us would. You know, if it was attacking a horse, sheep, whatever, we'd have a crack. But if it's not doing anything, we wouldn't shoot it because the risk of injury. Absolutely. And creating a man-eater is just too much. I know other idiots. I've met some complete fools, and we'd shoot it. And they've got a 2-2 rimfire and stuff like that. Absolutely irresponsible.
Very gung-ho approach, isn't it?
Very. They shouldn't have rifles or any type of weapon.
But is that more bravado, David, and something which, you know, you can't very easily trophy hunt one of these cats? You won't get permission for the land. You won't have the ability to work the wind direction if you're not experienced and know that location.
They want to do it purely for the financial thing. I've shot a big cat and bragging rights. The majority of people I know, if they did shoot one, they'd probably bury it out of sight, out of mind.
Hmm. The point about you taking aim at one, if it was about to be threatening, do you feel you'd be successful? I mean, it's going to be difficult to get a safe and accurate shot in that situation, isn't it?
I've won a lot of competitions, rifle and shotgun shooting. I've shot a lot of stuff from the hip on instinct. And if it's the cat or me, I'm afraid the cat, he's going to have his work cut out.
But in other perspectives, you would actually be very protective of them. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just to clarify that.
Not from protecting the cat itself, but from protecting people, because you don't want injured animals running around the countryside. Mm. If they can't hunt efficiently, they're going to go for the soft option, humans. And I'm sorry, I don't
or
want
to pets, yeah.
Or pets. Yeah. I don't want to put people's lives at risk.
I also think if you've seen one of these animals up close, when I saw the cats that I saw when I was young, I was just so in awe of just how incredible they were.
Yeah.
And the last thing in my mind would ever be trying to hurt one of them, ever, yeah.
And never mind about shooting it. You don't even think about getting a camera out.
That's very true, very true.
You're so absolutely awestruck. Cameras, what's a camera? You're so busy taking in what you're looking at. And a lot of people I know that have seen them, they've got camera phones and stuff now. When I saw them, a camera phone didn't exist. But I know people have seen them since, and the last thing they ever think about is the phone. And if you see a fox goes across the road. By the time you got the phone out, switched it on, found the camera, pointed it, it's gone. So you might just as well enjoy the view.
Very true.
Brilliant. Thank you, David. Nick?
Yeah, I'd like to think I'm observant when I go walking. I would love, really dearly love, to have another close encounter. It's not affected how I walk. I'm a solo walker. I always walk with a sturdy stick or a trekking pole. What good that would do, I've no idea. But the impression I had from the big cat I saw was that it was a lot more wary of me than I was of it. And as we've said, I was in awe of it. How I would feel in a different situation, if I was in woodland and I felt I was being stalked, I don't know. I really don't know how I would feel about that. I think walking through woodland, you often get that sort of prickling sensation that you think there's something around, but I've never seen anything. And I would just love to see the cat again. I often go back to the same walk, but perhaps doing it in the reverse direction, and I will go back to Hay on Wye, and who knows, I might be lucky again. But I suspect not. I think that was a once in a lifetime to be that close and to be that sure of what I've seen is just wonderful.
Have you been back on the web or in reference books and tried to clarify and match what you saw?
I have looked through Mr. Google and all the sites I can find, and I cannot find anything at all with similar markings that were almost regular, nearer to be square than round. The coat that I saw, it was approaching, as a guesstimate, 40% of the coat was markings rather than the fur itself. And I've not found anything at all that's similar. If you see a black cat, it's a black cat. This one was reddish brown with either dark brown or black markings. And because I couldn't find anything and any image of it, I assume that there's been some interbreeding and this may or may not be a one-off. I just don't know.
Thank you. Can I just ask somebody in the audience, if we can get Wi-Fi, could you just do a Google search on a more gingery melanistic leopard, and we just show that to you, just in case.
Right.
I don't like to jump the gun and put words in your mouth. It doesn't sound objective, but if anybody could do that while we're talking, and we get a view on that later on, because we did have one witness in one episode who saw one stalking deer, and he said it was reddish brown, and we do get chocolate brown ones reported. When you actually ask people, really press them to say, have you looked at that hue of tone of colour of melanistic leopards? Some people say, ah, yeah, I didn't know they went into that trend of colour as well, thought they were just black, but you may not have thought about looking at all the melanistic leopards on the web.
I didn't. If someone could find an image, that would be fabulous.
Yeah, not saying that is it, but we could may as well try if that we wouldn't mind doing that, somebody. Yes, I think Matthew and Mark are on the case. Thank you. So, Fleur, if you wouldn't mind swapping seats now, it's just we've got the microphone access for Fleur.
Really got much to add other than I've always loved big cats ever since I can remember, since I was a child. I was fascinated by Born Free, Living Free, Forever Free. I don't know if you remember the Adamson's books, those older of us here perhaps do. So it was just one of the greatest privileges to actually see a naturalised cat in the British landscape. I can't tell you how many times I've retracked that in my head. In terms of how I go about walking in the countryside, well, I do a lot of bird watching, so I'm always trying to be really quiet. I'm trying not to talk. And I tend to look down anyway and see what, say, if there's snow on the ground, what footprints are there. And if it's been muddy, like it is just now, you know, maybe there'll be some pad marks to look at and so forth.
Interesting that you say you had a very strong interest in this subject before your experiences and your encounters. Now, one counterpoint sometimes by absolute stubborn sceptics would be, oh, it's a wish fulfillment. You have wished to see a big cat and you have done. Plenty of people I know who wish to see a big cat haven't. Most of them wish to see one and haven't. So, but what would you say to that person who said, well, yeah, you invented it from your psyche because you were, you know, that's what you were looking for.
Yeah. Well, I can see how people would think that. But when I saw it, we were bird watching. We weren't looking for cats. We didn't know the cats were in the Purbeck. I hadn't come across Jonathan McGowan's writings. I hadn't listened to any podcasts. It was round about 2006, I think. So I don't think that's the case. With regard to my family member who was tracked, I think he was genuinely very frightened. And I don't think he would ever go back into that wood on his own ever again, because he was tracked and it was tracking him and he knew it and he saw it. So I know he has an opinion about this.
Can I just raise a very quick point? You mentioned about how quietly you walk. You don't talk and this and that. When I'm out shooting, I can hear people's voices half a mile away. My senses aren't nearly as good as a big cat. Yeah. If you want to see these things, silence. You walk slowly, a few steps at a time. You imitate the fox. A few steps at a time, you stay quiet. You listen. You feel your senses. I've seen stuff watching me. Now, the back of my hair's gone up on end, and I've turned around. There's been a fox sitting 50 yards away watching me. You go with your senses, and silence is key.
The noise factor has come up in quite a few encounters that I've heard from people, and there genuinely have been some where people said they were so surprised to come across one because they were noisy. and they thought, you know, that shouldn't have worked. But there's the issue that some older cats, just like domestic cats, and some people who almost stepped on them, sleeping and resting,
they will go deaf.
They will go deaf or harder of hearing. So, yeah, I think that is what's happening sometimes when people get really close.
I shouted at a fox. He was as deaf as a post.
Yeah.
Absolutely deaf as a post. And he came within feet of me.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, do we think these cats are deliberately anticipating preying on somebody, or are they curious, or are they just trying to pace you out of their area?
Well, that one that was following me, if he wanted me, he'd have had me.
Yeah.
The speed they move.
Yeah.
And where I had to go through a narrow gap, and if he'd really been preying on me, he'd have had me.
So curiosity or just pacing
you out?
I think
a lot of it's curiosity and possibly a young cat weighing up, what's he about, what's he doing?
Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Mark, could I just get Mark Graves, who we've heard from recently in episodes, to get a perspective on that from leopards in the bush in South Africa, when they're up close and they're checking us out. What do you think is going on? Because it may be more different in Africa, South Africa to Britain to some degree, but maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, my experience of leopards is that they will avoid human contact at all costs. So that they're not interested in tangling with us at all. As David's saying, I mean, they're moving at about 25, 26 metres per second in the full charge. So I'm not sure how close you were to that leopard that estimated that was falling, but
50 feet from the edge of the wood.
So that's a second. So one second.
Yeah.
If it wanted to ambush you.
Three or four bounds need to have been on me.
And even with a rifle in your shoulder to defend yourself, to hit its brain, which is the only way you'd stop it, moving at one second for it to cover that ground.
It'd have to be a pure instinct shot.
Yeah, and that brain is the size of a tennis ball.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we train against charging cats as walking guides, and one of the things we train the guys to do with cats specifically is to drop down onto one knee, so that you're more on alignment with the animal. So if you miss the brain, at least the bullet will travel down the body and cause maximum damage to that cat. If you try and do it from standing, it's almost impossible because it's closing so fast. Not that I'm advocating shooting cats at all. I think we all agree that we'd rather leave them be, but should it be necessary?
The distance I was, by the time you dropped down, it would have had to have been a standing shot. I wasn't sitting around. I wanted to get out of there.
Yeah, interesting. We've heard them following this footstep behavior. When they've got cubs, then they will sometimes follow to see potential threat out of their territory or where not their territory, but where the area where they have stashed their cubs. That's a possibility. Usually they're just more curious. So it could be a young sub-adult animal that's looking just sizing up what's going on, or it could be that were you working with dogs?
No, didn't have a dog.
So that's there. I mean, often people are walking with dogs, and they're not really interested in the person; they're interested in the dogs. So I think almost invariably they try and get away. So Nick's experience is a typical experience of coming across a leopard at short distance. That all you see is a blur of spots and colour gone.
Mark, while you've got the microphone, just a point about that's raised on the podcast sometimes by myself and others, and that is the leopards where you were have a tough life. They're hemmed in, they've got neighbours, they compete, they've got scavengers, all sorts of things are weighed against them. Do you think that changes their attitude to people and dogs being around, and they could be more of a threat or a problem to people and their pets in South Africa than they would be in here, where it's an easy life, there aren't many of them, and there's prey everywhere, and so not much is going to bother them. They're going to be, they're not going to be so stressed much of the time.
A couple of things. I mean, they're definitely more persecuted in Africa because they, in any country where they come into human conflict. I mean, any conflict with humans causes stress in animals. They become wary, but they become more aggressive. Obviously, if they're cornered, they become highly aggressive. You made an interesting point earlier about old animals becoming deaf, maybe blind. That wouldn't happen in Africa because they'd be taken out by something else, because although they are apex predators, there are plenty of other animals out there that would kill an animal that is subpar. It's the survival of the fittest, literally. Here, they truly would be the apex predator. There is nothing that would bother a deaf or a blind or a toothless big cat. So I can believe that, you know, here it would be possible to get an aging cat that would be in some way handicapped. You would never, almost never see that in Africa and the wild.
Yeah, yeah. A good example would be witnesses who told me they saw what they thought was an old arthritic-looking puma, mountain lion, sandy brown one, and it was going to their neighbour's koi carp pond and just helping itself to those. And they thought maybe that's what it's doing because it just cannot ambush deer anymore. And it did that about three times, and the dog grumbled when it saw it from the window at dusk. So maybe that was a strategy, you know, for old age.
Absolutely. I mean, they'll go for an easy option. I mean, they'll go for an easy option anyway, even when they're healthy.
Yeah.
They're looking for the least amount of effort for the reward of calories in. But surely as they get older, they'll look for very, very easy targets.
Great, thank you. Looking around the room, any final question to our witnesses? Thank you. Nathan over here. And then after this question, if one or two people could raise questions about what do all these witness reports across the podcast and across Facebook and everywhere else mean? You know, have we got a collective idea of what's going on from the report? So thank you, Nathan. Fire away.
Yeah, thank you. I think we hear so much about the sight and what witnesses see. Sometimes we hear about the sound, and perhaps your twos were much more close. I'm curious if you've ever managed to smell as part of your sighting, because even being 2 or 3 meters away from a deer, you can really quite strongly smell that deer. So I'm just wondering if either of you two could smell it, or if Rick, you've had sightings that the smells featured heavily.
Or other emotion, other senses. Really.
Yeah, apart
because
from sight and
that's
sound.
That's why I like to call these things encounters more, because, and often there's another animal with a person, a horse or a dog, that is spooked and is proving it's just, they haven't made a mistake. It's definitely something, you know, which has scared the dog or the horse or whatever. So, yeah, smell or other senses kicking in. David, especially you being a stalker.
When the one ran right in front of me, never smelled a thing. But I have been walking along. I know what foxes smell like, badgers and this, that, and the other. And I have smelt things. And what the heck's that? Is that a cat? But I've never had the opportunity to be in the area where there are cats urinating and defecating. So I'm not familiar with those smells. To be able to identify it, you need to be familiar. So personally, no, I've never knowingly, positively identified the smell of a big cat.
Did any other senses kick in beyond the visual?
The silence, the cat, when it came out of the black currants, 6 feet away, and I could hardly hear it. I could hardly hear a thing. It was bare soil. There was no grass or anything, but I could hardly, you could just hear a padding. When the Alsatian came out behind it, you could hear it scratching, and it was really going to try and catch up with this cat. You could hear it digging in and clawing at the soil with the cat. There was hardly any noise at all, just this shadow.
Thank you, David. Fleur?
Just a quick aside, really. I'm interested in folklore and medieval bestiaries, you know, where all the animals are described in the right eccentric detail. One of the things that the panther is described about is having a sweet smell about it. And this actually draws its prey to it. And we have these really quaint pictures. I think there's a wonderful bestiary in the Bodleian Library in Oxford where you can see the panther and all the little creatures and the animals and birds are coming towards it, drawn by this sweet smell. And some people have observed that the panther has a sort of nutty-ish smell. So I don't know. I've not had the privilege to get that close, but I'll just offer that up as an interesting medieval aside.
Can we just follow that up quickly before we go to Nick with Mark Graves?
So when we're walking in the bush, one of the things that we use all our senses, as you can imagine, but leopard scent marking has a very, very distinct smell. It's nutty is a good way of describing it. We often say it's buttered popcorn. So that smell of buttered popcorn, it's really, it's quite a pleasant smell, whereas most scent marking is acrid and you know, catty or fox or but most scent marking is quite offensive to us, but actually leopard scent marking is not an unpleasant smell. So that's interesting bit of information there.
Great. Nick, anything to add to that?
I had no impression of any smell or no sound. It was completely silent.
I wish now I'd gone over to where the cat had been in the undergrowth and had a look around and a sniff and perhaps even photographed the area, but I was just away with the fairies, just thinking what I'd just seen. It was wonderful, but no, it was completely silent, no smell at all, no sense of danger from my point of view, just a sense of wonderment.
Okay, well, we've had 9,900 podcasts, well over 100 reports and encounters. What do people make of what's going on? What are we learning from these witness reports and this consistent reporting of what seems to be mainly three cats of all the wild species? Any comments or reflections on what we're hearing?
They're definitely firmly established in the food chain, aren't they? Craig
established, again, yeah.
Yes, Craig. So I think they're firmly established in the food chain. They're obviously breeding. We aren't talking about individual animals here. I'm 53 now. I was 12 when I first saw the Black Panther, the Beast of Exmoor, and I was 30 metres away, and I saw it twice over a period of days. And those cats are still reported in the same area now. I had a report from someone down there about 3 weeks ago off the back of a tractor, saw one walking up a lane. So they're definitely not individual animals. They're here to stay. That's my opinion anyway.
Mm. On Exmoor, is there a view that they are changing their behaviour? Because they certainly seem to be really ravaging the sheep in those days in the 80s in that episode. But these days, rare to hear sheep kills anywhere, especially Exmoor. So is there a tolerance factor there kicking in and people are more tolerant because they're behaving themselves? Or what's the attitude, do you think, from your grapevine down in Exmoor?
Yeah, the grapevine is that the ban on hunting has really helped the availability of prey, because there's never been as many red deer on Exmoor as there is now. You know, I was down there walking a couple of years ago and I counted over 250 at a place called Preyway Head, and I've been going to Exmoor since I was 7 or 8, and I've never seen that many deer together. You know, so I don't know whether these cats are genetically predisposed to prey on deer rather than sheep. Potentially they are, I don't know, or potentially it's a better food source. But you know, the farmers I still speak to on Exmoor, no one's reported any sheep kills or any harassment. Whereas if you go back to 1982, Eric Lay, who was on one of the previous podcasts and actually encouraged me by listening to his tales to come and tell my story from 40 years ago, he had 50, 60, 70, I think the rumours were 200 sheep killed over a 2 or 3 month period. You know, but nothing like that now. I'm not that well connected on Exmoor because the people I used to stay with have sadly died a long time ago. But, you know, there's certainly no real news coming out of Exmoor about massive sheep predation. And I genuinely think that the people on Exmoor, probably like a lot of the country, are just learning to live alongside these animals.
Thank you, Craig. Can we just get a quick perspective from Alan? Because you run a Facebook group for Forest of Dean area. You go out following up reports. You use a thermal camera. You hear reports. You listen to the podcast a bit. What do you reckon on what's happening or what we're learning from people's reports and the grapevine?
I think people are becoming more accepting of them. It's sort of becoming day to day that people are sort of accepting that they're sort of losing their myth status. That they were, when I first moved to the Forest of Dean, it was the beast. And I was like, oh, black cat. So people are sort of warm into it more. I think people are more easy about coming forward, about talking to, about them, because there is such popularity, the groups that are on Facebook and things like that. People are sort of more aware of the situation as well, so they feel more comfortable coming forward. So I think it's becoming part of our accepted culture now. Which is good.
Yeah. You feel that Facebook and podcasts and the media reporting is helping these emerge in our sort of psyche and understanding then?
Yeah, and I think that when you talk to people and that you relay to them your personal sightings, and I do a lot of classroom teaching and stuff like that, and it always comes up during the day, and you get people who relay and you get that, I've never. And then somebody will say, well, I saw one. And they're like, did you? And then when it's somebody close to them who's actually relaying that rather than a stranger in the room, then they take it, you know, they're like, oh, wow, So it is a polarized subject. There are people who want to kill them all. And you are right, there are the trophy hunters out there who would want to. I was told of two that were shot on Exmoor by a horse farmer who actually brought a specialist team in because they were killing horses. And these were expensive race horses. So there is the two ends of that of that scale. So
yeah, great, thank you. You're reminding me of the time when I had Jonathan McGowan down. He's a great naturalist, and he was going to give a talk, an after school talk, to the Nature Club at the school where Owen goes to. Owen's doing the audio tonight for us, as he always does. And I briefed Jonathan to just stick to wildlife, to British wildlife, and not to mention big cats, because I didn't want to be blamed for going in and indoctrinating the kids on big cats. And Jonathan came back. I said, "How did it go?" He said, "Yeah, fine." He said, "But the very first question was," and he said, "I kept off big cats until the questions. Very first question, several of them wanted to ask it, sir, how many big cats are there in Gloucestershire?" Can't win, can you? So, right, final point about an overview on what do all these witness reports and encounters, you know, add up to? What are we learning from witness reports?
What I'm learning through my Facebook group and through the sightings that are relayed to me and people getting in contact, I'm now working out territories and ranges and where they're going and how they're interacting with each other and sort of how one animal has pushed one animal out of its territory. So I think those sort of things are really good.
Yeah.
That
by doing that, Alan, you are really trusting the detail of the witnesses, are you? Or you, not everyone, perhaps. Some perhaps maybe more detailed and credible and useful than others. But
you join the dots.
Yeah.
For me, it's joining the dots. The year before last, I had a sighting Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. And it was a direct line. So you can kind of say, yeah, and that happens every year.
And they didn't know of each other's reports?
No, that was one of them actually, I think it was the Friday night, actually got relayed to me about 6 months ago.
Okay.
So you're always joining the dots when you're trying to figure out what they're doing. Yeah. So,
and I remember two summers ago, between us in Gloucestershire and the Facebook groups and amongst Frank Tunbridge's network of informants and mine, we got five credible lynx reports, all very detailed, from people who hadn't a clue what a Eurasian lynx was, in Forrester Dean and different parts of Gloucestershire and the Cotswolds. And I suddenly thought, yeah, they're all credible, and they're in four different locations, you know. So there's possibly four lynx if we believe all those witnesses, and why shouldn't we? They were all very descriptive. So, yeah, there you go. You know, was that four lynxes in Gloucestershire from credible reports? Yeah, great. Mark, final point about this, and then we'll take a break.
Quickly, I'll just give a little anecdotal story. Interestingly enough, I also first heard about the Beast of Markle. Here we are at Much Markle, and I was probably similar age to Craig, so 40-odd years ago, when I first heard of the Beast of Markle, which was sighted many times literally in this area where we're sitting now. And that was my first introduction to the fact that there may be big cats in the country. At that stage, they were, for those that believe, which were very few, thought that they were escapees from private collections or from zoos or escapees in some way. I think my view, Rick, is that there's so much anecdotal evidence now. I mean, you've collected hundreds of very credible witness reports, very detailed. Even if we were to discount half of them or 80% of them, that still leaves an enormous number of genuine sightings. So the fact is, they're definitely here. We definitely have puma-type animals, black leopards, panthers, and Eurasian lynx. What is interesting now is exactly what Alan was alluding to now, is where do we go with that? How do we take that information? We don't need to prove that they exist. And the fact that they have been around, documented for 40, 50 years, when the lifespan can only be 20 years at maximum, I would imagine, means that there must be breeding populations. So what are they doing? How do we get the next level of information? How do we go from, oh, I saw one run in front of the car, to, okay, well, this is how many we've got, this is what they're doing, this is how they're interacting with their prey, this is how they're interacting with us, this is the conflict or the potential conflict, this is how we de-conflict with that situation. Where do we go from here? And I think that is, you know, 100 episodes of anecdotal evidence is wonderful. Now we need to start building more scientific proof, but I don't think I even need the proof. I know they're there. But we need more information. Now we need to find out what's really going on in the countryside. And that's my take on it.
Thank you for that. And what I would say about your proportion of credible sightings, well, you nailed it back to 20%. Well, I would say that's the percentage that have horses and dogs with people as well, and they are reacting as well. So it's not just people having missed sightings, the horses and dogs are picking it up as well. So there's 20% of all those hundreds that are very credible. But in terms of how are they behaving, well, we'll come on to that and how do we keep up with them, because our word of the week in a minute with you is going to be spore and tracking and scent marks and whatever, and how we discover all of that better than we're doing at the moment. But the other thing about observing them and understanding them is episode 84 with Don with his thermal camera. Here we see one mousing and going for leverets and going for pheasants in the evening at dusk, you know, just chilling out, you know, wandering around a field, knowing it's going to get several small prey and rabbits and things. And so that's so useful, but it's, of course, very difficult to do, to see one in the open with the thermal camera, expensive kit at night with landowner permission. But it's more of that that's going to help us learn more about them, certainly.
Absolutely agreed. Then it's joining the dots. So it's taking all these little bits of evidence and joining the dots. So sightings where you get an animal sighted every day traveling across an area gives us a huge amount of evidence. I think I mentioned in the first podcast we had, I mean, ideally, we would like to be able to trap and collar and release, because then we can follow and we know exactly what's going on. So that's a whole different can of worms. You know, we need to know exactly what's going on with these animals. And until we educate people to not be scared to look out, not be scared to report the evidence to us or to anybody who is interested, and we can build that bigger picture. But it's starting to happen. We've got a lot of citizen scientists out there, a lot of people who are fascinated, and a lot of groups that are doing great work. So it's the start, it really is.
Splendid. Thanks, everybody, for now. We'll have a short drinks break. But thank you. See you a bit later. Okay, we're halfway through the show, and I want to do a couple of thank yous now, so I don't forget at the end. So first of all, thank you to the pub, the Royal Oak Pub in Muchmarkle, Herefordshire, lovely part of the world. They have a steam rally here, they have autumn festivals for the orchards and the cider, Western Cider's just around the corner, and of course they have big cats in the local woods, so marvellous part of the world to visit if you're coming this way. Now, we are recording this on audio, so you can just listen to it on podcast players as usual as an episode, but we're also doing a rare event of putting a summary on YouTube. And thank you very much to a young filmmaker who is from Sussex and was very interested in the subject. I helped him with his final year project last year, making an input to that with Charlie Bones in Sussex. We enjoyed meeting Max there. And so Max is actually going to tell us about his interest in the topic in a minute. Later on, we talk about the cultural and creative side of this subject. Thank you, as always, to Owen for doing the sound levels and recording. We can't possibly do it without him. It's a very underappreciated role. So thank you, Owen, for all of that work. And it's now time for Word of the Week. And the word is going to be spore. And it's very much an underused word in the topic, but it's very important. And I think that conversation on spore will get us on to tracking and trying to find out more about the cats. And of course, we do have a very experienced tracker trail guide with Mark Graves here, so Mark is going to lead us off for a quick discussion on spore. So Mark, thank you very much.
Welcome. Spore, spelt S-P-O-O-R, is actually the reason why it's not so well used here is it's actually an Afrikaans word, so it's used widely in Africa, although it is becoming lingua franca more widely around the world. From the original Dutch and brought into the Afrikaans language. Now, it means not just tracks as in footprints. It means any sign that will, or any evidence that will help you to identify and follow an animal. So you can have broken leaves or twigs that show where it's walked. We talked about smell, scent earlier. That would be spoor. If an animal is wounded, or indeed a person is wounded, you could follow blood spoor. So it's any evidence that allows us to identify and then to follow and interpret, understand what that animal or person that we are following is doing. So that's spoor.
Thank you, Mark. And why do you reckon we are so bad at it in relation to big cats here in Britain? Is it because in South Africa, where you've had a lot of experience, your terrain is so dry and dusty and like talcum powder, so you get brilliant impressions of prints, you can follow stride patterns, and so we've got that disadvantage here, and they're messed up with dog walking. You know, a lot of us are trying to investigate and follow up big cat sightings and big cat events that we think are credible, but we're not finding much spoor in that full sense of the tracking and evidence of the cats.
I think, Rick, it's mostly a culture of understanding and learning. Yes, the environment is less conducive to tracks and tracking here, although having said that, it rains a lot and mud provides a great medium for tracks. But I think it's just because we don't know what we're looking for. That's the key. There is always sign. Nothing moves without leaving some sort of an impression, some sort of sign, some sort of spoor. It may be very hard to see. It may take an incredibly experienced person to understand and interpret that, but it's always there. There's always some sign. The trick is to know what you're looking for and then to find it and follow it.
We do also have the disadvantage here of so much of that is going to be on private land that's not going to be accessible, where it's on public land or rights of way, other people are going to be there, and you sometimes feel invasive and obtrusive to try and do that in front of them, especially if they've got kids and whatever. It's fraught with logistical, practical problems and issues. So, you know, we've got that against us as well.
Absolutely. And also, don't forget, most of the pathways we use, the public pathways, are highly utilised by people, dogs, animals, horses. So any original spoor may well have been disturbed or completely obliterated by other spoor that has come on top of it. So it is hard here, there's no doubt about it.
Okay. Amongst the boots on the ground people in this room, that David, you would find this from other animals that you're looking to dispatch or just observe, wouldn't you?
I see lots of tracks from deer and stuff, and where they've been browsing along the rides and stuff. But my shoot, the ground I'm allowed on, it's about 500 acres, and there's people walking across it all the time. The footpaths are well used, and it just wipes out anything that's there. And the more people about, the more they stay off the tracks anyway. And you can't, when the wood's full of brambles and stuff, it's difficult to get through it.
So, Mark, what's your advice? You know, we are failing, really, in our track and sign follow-up. We're desperately wanting to get better evidence on the track and sign side, and that will actually help us to put trail cameras in better positions and follow up. There are people who know what they're doing and know what to look for.
Yeah, I think that's almost every week you'll send me a photograph of a track, an individual pug mark, a print, and you know, you'll be, you know, do you think this is a possibility? It's very, very hard to identify a single track. We look at a number of things. It's like a game of elimination. So if I see a track that looks interesting, I will look for certain features on that track. If it ticks the boxes, I then look for other evidence that will back up what my gut feeling or my initial opinion is. And as you said, one of the most important things with cats particularly is the register. And the register means how the feet are placed as it walks. In a normal walking gait, you'll get a direct register with leopard particularly, which means that the back foot will land exactly where the front foot was. It's designed to walk as silently as possible through jungle environment, so you don't want to be stepping on the same twig twice. So any animals that are forest dwellers mostly will use a direct register. Now, obviously, if it's moving quickly, that hind foot will overtake where the front foot was, so we get an overstep. And if it's moving incredibly slowly, so it's in a stalk or it's going very, very cautiously and slowly because it's worried about something, you'll get an underregister where the back foot will fall short of where the front foot was. So a direct register isn't necessarily the be-all and the end-all, but if you get a direct register, that's a pretty good indication. Or it's another positive indication that we're on the right track for what we're looking for. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Excuse the background noise in the pub. Of course, we are in a pub and its phones are all part of the background vibes. But I would say that in terms of the signs of the cats that we are likely to be told about from informants or find ourselves through our grapevine, it is carcasses, mainly deer carcasses.
Yeah.
And unfortunately sheep carcasses in some situations that are going to give us our starting point, and from there we can then do our tracking. I think that's how it's been in the last few years. There's been plenty of good deer carcasses, especially this year, and some landowners unfortunately had sheep carcasses. You've seen some that I relayed to you, and I think you largely agree that they are almost certainly
indeed
big cat related. So
yeah,
I think it is, that's going to get us started, isn't it? The carcasses and following up from the carcasses and even putting trail cameras around them and not hoiking them away in case the culprit comes back.
Yeah. I mean, the carcasses, I think, are the reason why they are start point is because they're in your face. I mean, there's a dead animal in front of you. You can't really miss it. People aren't looking for the more subtle sign. Again, that's training. We can do training and we can teach people when they're walking to be looking for other things. But you're right. A carcass is right in your face. There's certain things that are pretty much dead giveaways. I mean, if we've got a carcass sort of 20, 30 feet up in a tree, it's unlikely to be a fox or a badger, quite frankly, you know. Mm-hmm. So
Unless it was hoaxed.
It's not 100%, but it's a good chance. So there are certain things that we look at that really heavily point us in that direction. But even a carcass on the ground, the way it's been eaten, the way the entrails have been taken out, the stomach lining has been left to one side, the organs have been eaten, the rear of the animal, the haunches have been stripped off, the plucking, which is very typical of big cat behavior, where they'll take the hair off or the feathers off to get to the meat inside. Moving of carcasses, picking them up and physically carrying them under a tree or up a tree, all of these sort of things. There's lots of sign that would point us towards it more likely to be a big cat. Mm.
I mean, the other thing about tracking and all of this is den sites. You know, if we can know where the den sites are, then that's where your trail cameras and more sign will be emanating from.
Absolutely.
But again, we hardly ever manage that. I think sometimes a private landowner will say, well, yeah, I'm telling you now because the cat's not there anymore, but we knew that we had a den site wherever. So landowners keep that quiet, especially if they're tolerant and positive about the cats, which most of the ones I come across are. So again, if we get better at tracking and finding the spore, following the spore, we'll learn about the den sites more, perhaps.
Absolutely. I mean, they also move, of course, as well. They don't just stick to one den.
The layup spots, I mean, more so, but den sites as well.
The other thing is, if you find something that's obvious, like a carcass, let's say a carcass is in a tree, so already that's giving us a fairly good indication that we're interested in how that carcass got into the tree. It's not just the carcass in the tree. So people tend to walk to the tree and they look up and they're trying to figure out whether a person took it up there or whether a cat took it up there. You need to treat this evidence almost like a crime scene. So it's all the other evidence that we need. So how did it get up the tree? It must have climbed up. Therefore, the claws must have gone in. There may be some evidence of some sheath from the claws left on the bark. There'll be scratches on the bark. There may be broken branches where it's dragged the animal up through the tree. It will have walked on the ground before it got to the tree. So there may be other evidence on the ground. Now, if we're all walking around the bottom of the tree looking at this carcass that's in the tree, we're destroying any potential supplementary evidence that may be on the ground. So when you see something that you feel is really interesting, try and take a step back or just not get involved in the area to start with and look the bigger picture. See what else is there. See if there's anything else you can notice. Are there some hairs? Is there some blood? How was that animal broken down? Was it plucked? Were the bits taken off it? Was it moved? Where was it killed? See if you can work that out before you actually get in and start poking the carcass, because each piece of evidence gives us a closer percentage to knowing what it is.
Can I just ask you, Mark, how often in South Africa would you come across scent scrapes, the sort of crescent scent scrapes? Because, of course, those are crucial for setting trail cameras because they're going to revisit those, or there's a signpost for another individual. And, of course, if we've got the right terrain for those and can see those, that's crucial. Some dogs might do really tidy ones and fool us here. That's the problem. But what was your experience in South Africa on that?
Yeah, I mean, the scent marking, sure, there's some scrapings on the ground, definitely. Also scratchings on the tree. There's a gland, an interdigitary gland between the toes. So that scraping is sharpening of claws, but it's also leaving a scent. And then there's scent marking up. So spraying of urine back and high, so it catches the wind. So on trees, on shrubs, on rocks, on logs, on anything that is slightly elevated that will carry that scent. These things can all be seen if you know what you're looking for and if you're expecting to see it. So if you feel that you have a territory boundary, and this is where it's going to start to get interesting, when we've got enough animals in a geographic location that they're coming up against each other and they're creating boundaries. I'm not sure how the scent marking will be here when there's not a physical boundary. They're moving over much bigger areas and they're maybe not coming up continually against a neighbor. When they are, they will start to patrol regularly, twice a week probably, and they will mark the same site several times, in which case it's very easy to put a trail camera up because you'll know that twice in a week they're going to come back and scent mark that area. So once the population builds and we have that information, those pictures, we'll be able to figure out much more easily where to put the trail cameras, I think.
Okay, thank you, Mark. That's queued up the next question, the next point, and this is very much out to the audience, and people have been briefed to be prepared for this one, so I expect a few good points on it. And that is, say we wanted to get more and better evidence, which we do, and you were individually given £5,000 sponsorship with no strings attached, what would you spend it on to get more and better evidence? You might disperse it across different things, different bits of kit. So trail cameras, thermal drones, get a scat detection dog trained, hire scent hounds, pay a reward for information and footage, you know, various things you could do. How would people spend £5,000 if it was given to them? Nathan, go for it.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in emotive evidence, and I think we all want to have other people agree and believe in us that what we're saying isn't completely out there. And I don't think toothpicks, DNA, or hair traps, there's nothing wrong with them. They're incredibly valid pieces of evidence. But when you want to hit it big, go viral, and kind of leave in people's own minds the decision making, you want something emotive. And that's why I think audio and visual through camera traps are the way to go. So, I mean, there's strategy around where you put those, and 5K probably wouldn't buy you enough camera traps to densely trap even one site. But if there was a way to pin your hopes on one thing, I think what will get people on board is camera. And especially you're talking about densites. If you look at things like Planet Earth, if you can get footage of a mother and her cubs, that is the ultimate emotive footage that will do the convincing in the minds of those people that hadn't given it thought before, and will reach people in a way that a DNA evidence won't. So yeah, I'd spend it all on cameras.
I think it's very interesting that your priority is on that resonance, that visual aspect, and that the social media influence. You're not downplaying the science, you're just saying that there's a priority for the visual, and I think we do live in a very visual world. So anybody want to reinforce that or have a different view? Alan, you are a thermal camera guy, aren't you?
Yeah.
Would you buy better and more thermal camera kit, or what would you do?
I'd probably be looking at something like a Starlight camera.
The ultimate, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you get one for £5,000.
But towards it, so that will go towards it.
I know a guy who might be able to help. So. But yeah, that's where I'd be going, Starlight. Thermal is good, but you do get left with the blob on a lot of occasions.
You've got two blobs that are potential pumas, is that right?
Yeah. I've got one you can clearly see, it's a big cat, and one you can definitely see, it's a blob. That's the one that's sitting beside the lake. Yeah, so
you could see it through the naked eye that it was a cat, but the camera didn't see it as sharp as you did, is that right?
We were in two minds. Where we were, there is a feral dog in that part. It's a husky that's gone sort of feral. Mm-hmm. And at one stage we were kind of making the decision, what was it? Because it was, we couldn't see it, and then when we put the torch on it, we could definitely see it was a human.
Is that part of the problem with thermals? They do give you a good view of something at night, and like we've learnt from Don's in episode 84 in Derbyshire, we've seen one foraging, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's really helpful. But you need to be closer up or have top-notch, very expensive thermal camera to have it really clear.
Yeah, and it's also weather-dependent. Yeah, anything, moisture in the air, just...
Scotch mist nights are just good.
Reduces the range, makes them vague. A winter's night, where it's really cold, or a good summer night as well, they're brilliant. You can get real clear, fine detail. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
No worries.
Dave Dickinson, can I put you on the spot? You're a trail camera guy, got a lot of experience. So £5,000 in your pocket, what would you use
it on? I wouldn't spend it all in one direction. What I would do is... contact someone who will believe that, first of all, that big cats exist in the UK. I'm not talking about David Attenborough, but one of his associates, you know, and use some of their gear, hire some of their gear, and get the money back from hiring it, once they get good footage, to sell that footage to the BBC or whoever. Their kit, you're talking £100,000 worth.
Yeah, that Starlight camera type stuff.
Yeah. But once you've got that footage and you can prove that it's in the UK, suddenly people are that much more interested. I mean, some of the kit that they use on what is it, Blue Planet and what have you, I mean, the quality of the video is just outstanding. You know, I'm talking about thermal imaging. People get confused. There's image intensifiers. There's Starlight cameras, there's thermal imaging cameras. Starlight cameras were developed by the MOD, but for the military, obviously throughout the world. Basically, it's a measurement of how much light level there is. And that will work right down to the light, one star, right up to full moonlight or whatever. So there's sort of three types of nighttime cameras, really. But if you can persuade, you do know people in that field, some of their kit would give some really good footage. It's just persuading them to do it in the first place.
Yeah, I take your point, and I do think it's a good strategy. What I would say is that we forget that, or it's not so apparent really, that all the stuff that you see on these high-end elite nature programs have huge amount of logistical setup and local information.
Yeah.
So those people are just going in with that kit and all the prep's being done, and they are virtually guaranteed to get success.
Yeah.
You hire it for Britain for our purposes, we're probably guaranteed to get no success for months, and that is the problem. So that, and it's why some of these people do not invest their time and resources in big cats. Some of those people are really genuinely interested in big cats. I had one guy interviewing me once who actually told me in the break he'd seen one, and he was interviewing me and having to be neutral, but I knew he'd seen one. But he wasn't going to admit that, because he told me he saw it with binoculars in the Norfolk Broads, lying up and moving off. So that sector is not going to move until they're guaranteed success.
With your podcast, you're funneling in people that have seen them, and some of them, I can think of quite a few interviews you've done on the podcast, you're talking to people, they actually know where they are on a regular basis. You mentioned Derbyshire in particular.
You're right, but on that case in point, and I did mention it, I think, in a recent podcast, 98, is that... we have had offers to help for more kit. The problem is the permission for that land, the landowners for that area, you don't want to be too invasive. If you hoiked in a lot of other kit, you would be so apparent, and it would disturb the animal, disturb local people. They'd think, what's going on? The landowners would start getting a bit more fidgety. So that's how it's tactically very difficult.
I mean, if you can find someone who's surrounded by their private land, that helps a lot. And okay, get the footage, but you don't have to say when or where it was.
Sure.
You know, that's, you don't have to give that away.
Yeah. You would spend the money on trying to get footage rather than DNA and scientific, because you believe the footage is the more influential thing.
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, a friend over there said about sound and vision. Well, you're only going to get that with. I know you're against video on trail cameras, Rick, but...
Well, only because I think that the batteries will run dry and you won't get anything. Yeah. That's all. I would rather have that. Still-
pictures, you're not going to get sound, are you? You know, but yeah.
I think the sound point is very good, Nathan.
Well, on that, then, instead of spending 5k on cameras, spend 5k on, I don't want to say bribes, but these people who have footage that sit on it that don't want to release it. If they've got a price and there's audio visual footage out there that exists, then go that way with the money as opposed to buying cameras. But again, those people won't do it for reasons you've covered before.
Yeah.
But maybe they would for 5K.
Yeah, well, I've been brokering that sort of deal for people, and tenant farmers, why would tenant farmers who filmed a puma release that information, violating their agreement with their landlord? So same with the gamekeeper. Your gamekeeper obviously has got a lot to lose, David, if he gives up those 30 pictures of a black leopard that are 10 feet away or whatever.
Rick, I don't.
Yeah, Craig.
I love technology. I'm a techie. I earn my living in technology. I would use it to create a, start to create a database that has a national register of sightings. So you can start to do predictive analysis using AI that we all hear about in the press. You'll then be able to work out the routes where these cats go at a certain time of year, and then when you can have a high level of accuracy to predict a proper sighting, that's when you get those cameras involved. And the technology exists today. If the various groups across the UK could work together to build a national register, you'd be able to understand and predict using technology quite quickly where these cats are, their trails, their patterns of behaviour, and at that point throughout the year you could work out your best and optimal chance to photograph. And then you get the vision, you get the audio. That's the best way to do it.
Thank you. And there are databases, and the actual way of coordinating them and synchronising them is very difficult. All kinds of issues there. In terms of predicting where the cats are going to go, somebody on Exmoor, actually, a farmer that ran a shoot and had big cats visiting their land and had lots of sightings information years ago, said to me, if you want to film a big cat on Exmoor, go to where the red deer are calving.
Absolutely.
From May to June.
Absolutely.
And then on to August or September when the fawns or calves or whatever are out. Because cats throughout the world go target neonates of the ungulates.
So I know where a lot of those sites are.
Yeah.
Because I used to hunt years ago when you were allowed to do it. So it's eminently achievable.
Yeah.
But I do think technology's got a massive part to play in this, because the amount of number crunching few hundred quid's worth of Azure or Microsoft Azure or Amazon technology could give you with AI would massively help. You might narrow it down from this to that, you know.
The other thing, those cameras have a nasty habit of walking.
Stolen cameras.
They walk,
Even on private land, yeah. That's why I use cheap ones that are behind me and on display. But
I won't put trail cameras up because people are wandering around everywhere. Yeah. They're not supposed to be there.
No.
Oh, I'll go up there and have a look.
These modern ones that you can get cheap, £30-40, the latest generation of them are much faster triggering these days and have longer illumination. I think that's long illumination at night is absolutely crucial for these kind of critters.
Can you hire an in-season puma and walk around the countryside?
It's been tried, hasn't it? Felicity was let loose for a press call, wasn't she, in Scotland? Yeah. Right, more bids for your £5,000. Would somebody spend it more on the science side?
It's not enough. You need way more than £5,000 to delve into the science side of it, don't you? But if you've got £5,000, kind of go into what these guys are saying about the visual or the audio footage, I'd say.
You might be able to do a scoping study for that amount of money, perhaps. Yep. And there are some intriguing possibilities. For example, if you parallel what's been done in archaeology, looking at populations and individuals, for example, where you've got a tooth, you'll look at a tooth with strontium analysis, and you may find out that person was brought up in Switzerland or on the continent, and they've landed up here. It'd be very interesting to think if you had a carcass of a cat, whether you could extract a tooth and maybe work out whether it had been living here for half a century.
They did that with that skull they found, didn't they? They found a leopard skull.
There was a leopard skull, but that was a plant, wasn't
it? Yeah, fake.
Yeah. They found it wasn't native to this country.
James, you're right, it is expensive, but you could do something, you know, DNA tests £120, that sort of thing, but logistical, problems. Practical problems, yeah. David Smith, how would you spend your £5,000?
I wouldn't spend it all on trail cameras,
mm-hmm.
because I think a lot of them would end up walking and you'd lose some money.
If that wasn't a factor, like your £5,000, you knew that the cameras are never going to move, would you still spend it on?
Yeah, if I knew they wouldn't, where I live,
yeah, fair
they'd
enough.
Be gone.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people who lost a lot of trail cameras.
But you have seen photo bursts. To answer Dave Dickinson's point, that I agree largely video is better, but David's, you saw 10 lots of bursts of three on the trail camera. Mm. Yeah. So you were seeing the movement, and that was close enough.
Yeah.
And most of them
It was really good.
Was it daylight or night time?
A lot of them were daylight.
Yeah. Okay, there's different events. It came different times, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Different places on the shoot. But the best one was when it was standing by the gate.
Yeah, because you could see the scale.
You could see the scale, you could see the shadows all lined up with the gate and everything. It was absolutely, you couldn't get a better picture.
Mm.
But it'll never see the light of day.
No, it's fair enough. Yeah, Mark, what would you go for?
Maybe some sort of a competition in the press or online, looking for photographic evidence and put a prize money up or something like that. Just see what comes out of the woodwork.
Flush people out with a bribe.
Put a proviso in there, caveat that it's anonymous, that there's no geotags on it, or, you know, that it's just the picture. And then you've got to try and verify it, obviously, which is going to be the trick. Was it taken in this country? Was it? Yeah.
Mm. And people, you're hoping then that people will be motivated to release that if it was for the greater good and greater understanding.
It's more about the ad campaign as well. It's more about public awareness. So, because I think that would generate public awareness. And I think the more people who know about it, the more people who know that it's interesting rather than just something to gloss over, I think you might find there's an awful lot more that comes out. It's not enough to do anything massive with, you know, in terms of technology or in terms of science.
Mm. But, I mean, a part of the reason why we're not making so much progress on this topic is that we don't have resources. It is about time. Yeah. And money, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Probably a lot more than 5,000.
Oh, yeah. But 5,000 is a nice little start to think about what your pet project, how it would fund your pet project. But, I mean, what about a scat detection dog? Would anybody consider a scat detection dog? What do you think, Mark, from South Africa perspective?
Well, you could train a dog to be species specific. So it would be definitely possible to train, maybe repurpose a bloodhound or, you know, a mink hound or one of the old scent hounds to specifically look for cats. And they wouldn't just be scat. They would find scent markings, they would find anything that had that scent on it. So it would be possible. It cost, I think, probably, again, more than 5,000 to train the dog. And then it's not just train the dog, it's the handler, it's the management of that dog. And where would you deploy that dog?
Yeah.
Do you wait for someone to phone in and say, well, I found some scat, I think it might be a leopard, and then you've got to go up there and someone's going to spend a day tracking, all good ideas, but I think 5,000 is...
Unless you had your own one. But even then, it's the practicalities of making sure it's got regular, repeat training exercises on that.
It's a daily job. It's a daily job. You have to be someone who is... That's what they do as their passionate hobby.
Yeah, it's not a part-time pet.
No. I think I might take the money and go to the Malay Peninsula and see if I can see them in their wild environment and learn something.
Great.
Craig, did you have a point? Yeah, no, I was just going to say, years ago in Exmoor, we actually got the Devon and Somerset foxhounds to track what was killing the sheep before we actually saw the cat itself. And then afterwards, they tracked the cat, knowing it was a cat, and they regularly followed the scent for 6, 7, 10 miles, and then the cat disappeared. So these animals can be tracked, and packs of hounds that still exist today can potentially be repurposed to do that. And I remember, and I say on the podcast with Rick, I remember the captain of the staghounds, a guy called Ronnie Wallace at the time, standing there saying, we followed it for 2 hours and then it just disappeared. And in all likelihood, it's bottom of the tree.
Yeah.
If only someone had gone, oh, look.
Yeah,
you do wonder whether we could approach a pack of hounds or a hunt, maybe on Exmoor, and say, let's try it.
Yeah, other hunts have admitted, not publicly, but have admitted to other informants and indirectly to me that they have flushed these animals out.
Yeah.
But the last thing a hunter's going to do is admit that, because of the commotion, and the animal is going to very quickly
And what's the ethical, the whole...
haven't then gone and shot it. Or,
no, but you're following out, you're chasing an animal, so you're back now into the whole sort of ethics side of it.
Legal morass.
Yeah, I think a single scent hound that's causing minimum impact. I mean, you're right, they repurposed the hounds very quickly to become aniseed scent drag hounds or whatever. So, and it took them a couple of months to change the packs over. So it should be possible, but it does require time and effort and continual handling from somebody.
Okay, right. We spend a lot of money there on different projects. But, Okay, finally, can we, in the final few minutes that are left, could we talk about this cultural aspect and why are we intrigued about these animals and why are they part of folklore? Why do we have beer brands on them and why do young people from the creative industries? We have a lot of people from the creative industries listen to the podcast and get in touch with me with ideas and projects, which is great and heartening. And I think it's probably easier for those young people in the early stages of their career to admit they're interested and want to get interested and do something to contribute to the subject. Because if you're a young zoologist or young ecologist, to actually say I'm interested in big cats and want to do something, that's obviously a status issue, a reputation issue and a tactical thing. Do you actually admit that you're interested in something unorthodox? So, Max, can we put you on the spot? And for you, does it matter where the subject goes? Or is it because it's a mystery, because there's a mystique behind the animals and they're very charismatic? As a filmmaker, do you just go wherever the story goes, wherever it evolves?
I don't want to press anything too much. I think for me, my objective was always, and still is, it's an ongoing project, is to, I think there's no harm in opening up people to the idea of new things. I think it does people good, especially now. And everything seems, you know, to a lot of people, especially in urban areas, things seem quite set in stone. Everything has an answer. There is no harm in opening up people to the idea that there are things that we might not understand, or, hey, chat to this person who's lived in the countryside for five generations. They know things that aren't in books. They know things that are to be discovered, that they're to be delved into. Someone was to watch my documentary eventually, and I open them up to some of these ideas, and they go to me, oh, I didn't consider those things, that's got me on this path, it's got me thinking, it's just a shift, a sort of cognitive shift of some kind. I'd be chuffed with that, I think, and to see one myself as well.
So people, listeners, know what you're talking about. You've done a little documentary, yeah, which is your final year project, and Charlie Bones is on that, I'm on that, and one or two others are on that, and you've done other stuff. So how was that received at the uni?
It was good. I think I was at uni in London, and so it was quite a lot of international students, and so a lot of it went over their head. I think people are quite used to the beast involvement in the tabloids. They kind of understand its historical weight, or it's a thing already in England, the sort of the legend of it, I suppose. What I want to go out and get more of is really strong witnesses and really strong anecdotal evidence and that kind of thing. And when you go and film someone and you go to the spot, they saw it, or they walk you through the description, that kind of thing, you see people light up in a way that's, I think, really compelling. With your podcast as well, fundamentally, a lot of it's held up on the reports, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
And I think, I agree with a lot of people about the video, and that's what we want to see, because I think for a lot of people, the science goes over their heads. And I think that's it, until it's a really simple science, and the science that everyone already understands and can communicate through. I think it's got to be layman, man on the ground, witness kind of thing.
But DNA for a leopard is DNA for a leopard, isn't it? We just had that in Gloucestershire. Yeah. The point about them being black, is that helpful? I was asking you over tea earlier on, if they were all mountain lions and all sandy brown, is there less of a mystique about, does the black really help, and the fact that black panthers have got this edge about them?
It does have more of a mystique and more of a mythology and a history in that sort of mythical sense. But I think for me, what's more appealing about that is, and mythology in general, is it's a tool for a more sort of artistic, creative way of looking at the past. We're all here, we're excited about this topic and how 100, 200 years ago people were too, and they were writing songs about it, or they were doing paintings about it, and how it kind of hasn't changed in that way. They might have had a sighting, and there wasn't a podcast back then, so they drew pictures or whatever it was.
Great, thank you. Any other perspectives on this subject in our culture and folklore and all that?
I was just going to say that you sort of saying, oh, there's a DNA result. Obviously there is, but I just think it's a case of not many people know about it. Like, you know, it was in the paper for a day. It went over so many people's heads. So it's also like getting the information and PR and actual marketing of your podcast more, and films can do that. And
I think general piece of evidence more universally, you know, we're all here. And yet there was a bit earlier where you said, oh, we already had this X type of evidence, and someone here didn't know that. It's the fact that we're quite a niche, and within that people don't know that, oh, we've already had a sample of this, it's happened. You know, that needs to be more universally.
And that's where communication, using media, using people like yourself is absolutely important. You know, we need communication strategies for this, certainly.
I think publicising the podcast helped, because people hearing the stories, they think, well, I saw one, I'll write in. again, you get more and more witnesses. And
yeah, we've had two journalists now recently on the podcast who said that they get a lot of reports off the record, just like I do and other recorders do. And people say, we don't want this out, but we want to know that we saw one as well.
Yeah.
But for status or whatever, they don't want it out. So reports build on reports. They definitely do.
A lot of it's ridicule. The ridicule.
People fear ridicule, but people fear invasion of their land, as we said. But
farmers but ridicule and for the people who don't own the land. Mm. I was teased rotten in the middle of a pub one night, and this guy, 12 months later, he saw one, and bless his soul, he's gone now. He came forward in the pub. Most of the people that were there 12 months before were still there. He said, I've got an apology to make to you about that cat, because he called me a barefaced liar. In front of everyone, he said, I've seen one now. And the pub went dead quiet, and everyone goes, wow. Is it this guy, if he said he saw one, he saw one. And that's, you know, you need that sort of thing to get people talking.
Yeah. But also, if we do it through folklore and storytelling and filmmaking, it's almost like, well, that's something else that is slightly abstract, but it's bringing the subject to the fore.
Yeah.
So I think that it can help in a way, acclimatise us. But it's very much a multidisciplinary subject, I think. You know, we need trained ecologists and zoologists, but people who understand witness reports and the psychology of people and journalists and the cultural creative industry and young photographers as well. I mean, we met Isaac I've had another guy from Cheshire wanted to just go to the sites where credible witness had been and just say, this is it, this is where. And we had the Economist article feature last year in the summer where they actually superimposed black leopard photos onto some of the key parts of the Cotswolds and Gloucestershire landscape. That was quite a good bit of communication, because you could then really visualise what these animals look like in our landscape. Nathan?
Yeah, just to say, I think folklore has been an important part of big cats. There was probably people in the Egyptian period sitting in side rooms and drinking establishments talking about big cats in hushed voices. But we're now in a day and age where there can be conclusive evidence. And if we want to, people say society is like an amoeba, it grows from the edges. And we are holding fringe beliefs here, no matter how valid we feel they are. And maybe for the first time in human culture, we're at a point that we can present conclusive evidence with the technology that exists. 4K cameras, DNA results, isotope analysis, those things just weren't around before. So maybe the cultural picture in the 21st century will change faster than it ever has around big cats. And maybe that's just my hope.
And with social media. Like, social media changed the whole thing for big cats, really, didn't it? You'd probably say.
But also, I think social media can be a blockage as well, because it can prevent people releasing something, because they think, I don't want this going out, it's just staying within the confines of my family or whatever, my private domain. So, but potentially, it's something to harness, certainly. Final point on culture and folklore.
I think the first time a cat was found in a human grave, showing there was a link between the two, well, not just a wild animal, it was 10,000 years ago, Cyprus. Whether it's feline or canine, they've been our kin. We respect them. We should respect them, whether they're wild or they're domesticated. And I think that's the heart of what we're all trying to share here.
Splendid. I think we're going to wind down there, because we're going to be kicked out of the pub in half an hour's time, and we've got to eat some cake. We have some panther cupcakes. So we'll have a group photo with those in a minute. You can see that on the website and perhaps on the YouTube version of this. So thanks, everybody, for contributing to our pub gathering for the 100th episode. Thank you to the listeners across the world. We are listened to in scores of countries across the world in every continent. It's so heartening that there is this wider interest. Obviously, majority of our listenership is Britain, and we're all one big family and community, and we get lovely support from listeners from all perspectives. But many other people are just curious from different sectors. So please keep in touch. We will have the next episode now. This is coming out in August. We're taking a three-month break. The episode 101 will be out in November, just because I need a bit of a break, and we'll catch up with ourselves then. So thanks, everybody, for chipping in. Thanks to Owen and Max again. And we're off for some cake, and I think we're done. So thank you very much for joining in Big Cat Conversations.